Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are beset, I think it's fair to say, with the cumulative effects of, well, now well over a decade, of efforts that have been made primarily under the banner of the Obama-Biden administration, whose third term, I believe we are in at the moment, to engage in something that Barack Obama famously declared on the eve of his first presidential election, namely the, quote, fundamental transformation of the United States of America. This has entailed an assault against every institution of our government and our country to morph us from the constitutional republic that has magnificently guaranteed our unalienable God-given rights and freedoms and inexorably moved us in the direction of what I think is just another Marxist-dominated entity, soon to be incorporated into some new global governance arrangement in which, again, our rights and freedoms will be very much a thing of the past. If this doesn't sound something that you particularly cotton to, welcome once again to Securing America, because it's not something we fancy either, and are working, among other things, through the educational opportunities this platform affords to try to make sure that all of our countrymen and women understand what is afoot at the moment. A man whose judgment on such matters I have long regarded very highly is, I'm very happy to say, our first guest. His name is Dr. Scott Powell. He is a senior fellow at a wonderful organization, the Discovery Institute. He is the author of a number of very important books, including one of my favorites, entitled
Covert Cadre.
I forgot it. Including one of my favorites, Covert Cadre. And most recently, a very important and very timely book, Rediscovering America, which talks about our national holidays as a prism through which to understand whence we came and where we are at the moment. He's a good friend and very valued colleague, and we're always delighted to have him as a guest here at Securing America. Scott Powell, welcome back. I'm anxious to talk with you about this fundamental transformation business.
Well, thank you, Frank. A very generous introduction. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about what you think Barack Obama meant when he talked about the fundamental transformation of America, informed by, of course, not only our speculation about him and his background and his motivations, but what he actually did and arguably is still doing through the cat's paw of Joe Biden.
Well, Barack Obama is a largely misunderstood figure in terms of, you know, the popular culture. You know, he's viewed as a suave, sophisticated, kind of cool guy, our first black president. And we celebrated that. We really did. As American people, we celebrate diversity. But his background raises many, many questions. First of all, he was raised in Muslim schools. And then when he was coming of age, he was trained by Frank Wright in Marxist theory. And so Barack Obama has been shaped really from his childhood through his adolescence. And then, of course, when he was beginning his career, I mean, it's questionable exactly what he did in college because he's covered up all those records at Columbia, Harvard, and so forth. But he was then involved in community organizing in Chicago, and that was largely founded by Alinsky's organization, Alinsky was a hardcore nouveau Marxist who believed that he wanted to take down America. So does he buy into all of that? Well, we look at his record in his presidency, and he brought turmoil to the Middle East. He couldn't stand up against the radical ISIS, couldn't get that job done. Trump got it done in 2 weeks. He did more harm than any president in memory in terms of our foreign policy and our stature in the world. So
the apology tours being absolutely one of the memorable features of that time. And domestic policy as well?
Domestic policy also, yes. I mean, we basically had this birth of an institutionalization of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Critical race theory was not a common term back then, but critical theory goes back to the 1930s in the Frankfurt School. It is a cultural approach to transforming our country. We are in a, much like what China went through with its cultural revolution, there are a lot of parallels between the cultural revolution in China and the cultural Marxist revolution going on in America
today.
Well,
it's the same playbook, I think, no question about it. Scott, two things that I just wanted to inject here. One is, you mentioned that we celebrated Barack Obama's becoming the first Black president, diversity, and so on. I think personally that many of us, not myself, but many Americans, embraced his candidacy as president in the belief that it would really put behind us once and for all the whatever lingering elements in the legacy of racism in America. It was a proof positive that we were above that now. And what you've described and what I think is the unmistakable legacy of Barack Obama is he did more to inflame racial tensions than anybody, certainly in recent memory, maybe going back to the Civil War days or, post-Reconstruction. But the point is, I'm looking at this. Sorry, my dog is audibly barking. I want to just draw you out on this idea that what was done was essentially a bait and switch on the American people, that the fundamental transformation was going to be actually taking us in the opposite direction of post-racism.
Yeah, to put that in the proper context, Frank, we have to remember that the Civil War did not solve, yes, it emancipated the slaves, it gave them voting rights and so forth, but bringing about fundamental change in a society can take generations. And so we had Black laws and Jim Crow laws, segregation, discrimination well into the 20th century, but God raised up Martin Luther King. And King really, through his arduous struggle of about 15 years, where he went to jail 29 times, and he ultimately gave his life for a true equality, for the assessment that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. And so much good came out of that civil rights movement. So when Obama came into office, it was reversing all of that progress that we had made. But of all the institutions that do not have a racial discrimination problem or have probably the least amount of it, the military represents that because people go through training.
Hold the thought, Scott. We have to take a very short break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the military's record of meritocracy that judges people by the quality of their performance and That's content true. Of their character, not their race. We'll be right back with more with Scott Powell right on the other side of this break. Stay tuned. Mm-hmm. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, the House of Representatives felt compelled to affirm America's support for the State of Israel. It effectively repudiated the rising democratic anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism before a senior Israeli official speech today to a congressional joint session. Unfortunately, the Biden administration's policy towards the Jewish state reflects such vile sentiments too, as evidenced by, among other things, the choice of its head of state, not the leader of its government, to address our nation. Team Biden is working with President Yitzhak Herzog's leftist allies who seek to overthrow a man they all detest, who happens to be Israel's democratically elected leader, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Worse yet, Obama-Biden 3.0 persists in empowering those seeking the destruction of our most important ally in the Middle East. Consequently, Iran and its proxies are becoming more dangerously aggressive by the day. Please, repudiate these policies, too. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Scott Powell, a very thoughtful man, about the history of overcoming racism in our country and what has been done of late, particularly under what I call the three Obama-Biden terms, to reintroduce, in fact, to inflame racial tensions in our country. And how that is now being very dramatically and dangerously manifested in the United States military. And Scott, we had to take a short break at the moment. You were just about to pivot to what I think is really the last institution to fall to this kind of cultural Marxist march through the institutions. Talk about where you think the U.S. military is in this regard at the moment.
Well, first of all, the last institution is the most important institution for the defense and the protection of America as a sovereign nation. So our military needs to have its morale high, and it needs to have readiness and fighting capability.
Unit cohesion.
Among cohesion at the top level all the time. So when this cultural Marxism moved into the military, this was a disaster for the morale of the military. And in fact, you know, the recruiting shortfalls that we're experiencing now in all branches of the military are a direct function of this, you know, the recognition by people that there is a, you know, that they're going to be subjected to things that are just not in keeping with what they want to go in the military to do.
No doubt about it.
They don't want to.
When you talk about this, Scott, when did we really begin to see this sort of critical race theory indoctrination and all that has flowed from it get inserted into the military?
Well, I'm not an expert on exactly when it began to creep into the military institutions like West Point and Annapolis, but we know in the Obama years that he fired 197 generals and admirals, and those were largely replaced with more progressive officers. So the cultural transformation took place in the Obama years, and of course, you know, some of that was reversed or at least put in abeyance in the Trump years. And I must say, for all the great things that Trump did, I think he was perhaps weakest in understanding this dynamic going on in the military.
Yeah. Well, and to some extent, personnel was his biggest shortcoming, really.
Yes.
But in the military, unless you really are going to step in and clean house, which we can come back to as a necessary corrective at the moment. But unless you were to do that, you basically are dealt a hand. You have certain people who are in the personnel pipeline, and they have been promoted in the course of the two first Obama-Biden years, some very aggressively promoted for that matter. And when you are the president of a different political persuasion, shall we say, and it has a different view, I think, certainly on critical race theory. Donald Trump wanted no part of that once he figured out what it was about. You nonetheless are going to have people who are imbued with some of those priorities moving up the tape. And one of those is the fellow that has now been tapped by the man, that is currently doing business as our commander in chief, Joe Biden. Although I think it is correct to say that he is still very much under the influence of, if not being essentially handled by, Barack Obama and his team.
Well, he's also,
and that would be C.Q. Brown, Charles C.Q. Brown, a general who is a four-star general, now the chief of staff of the Air Force, been nominated to become the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What can you tell us about him, and does he prompt the kinds of concerns that we've just been discussing?
He most certainly does. He's an unapologetic advocate and promoter of diversity and equity and inclusion. And that, together with critical race theory, both have their roots in Marxist ideology. Marxism, people have to understand, is a wrecking ball to take down Western civilization, to take down America. So why anyone in the military would embrace these ideas that have their roots in class warfare is, it's crazy. It's the opposite of what you want in the military, which is cohesion and unity, esprit de corps, working together, which the military does very well, by the way, without any of these programs.
Right. Which it has to do, actually. That's its right. That's its mission. But, you know, you mentioned class warfare. Class is, of course, what Mao waged his cultural warfare about. But in our country, I think it just didn't have the kind of appeal.
Right.
But race.
It's race.
As
an
alternative, race. But right. For the same purpose as a fracturing us and ultimately taking down our military. Is very much the Marxist playbook and agenda. And Scott, just on C.Q. Brown, clearly under his leadership, the Air Force Academy has become one of those incubators of Marxism, the cultural form and the race piece of it in particular, but also the transgender agenda and so many other elements of social engineering that have undermined the academy, for one. And by the way, there's a terrific group, Stand Together Against Racism and Radicalism in the Services, STARS is its acronym, that has been making book on what's been going on at the Air Force Academy. Judicial Watch has just produced a trove of Freedom of Information Act requested information that is very alarming. And I just have to say, the idea that particularly over time, if you can transform fundamentally, to use that expression, the leadership cohort of the United States military, it's just a matter of time before it is no longer ready. It is no longer of high morale. It is no longer evidencing the unit cohesiveness that is essential to, well, both deterrence and war fighting as well. Is that where we find ourselves now, or at least are we well in that trajectory, thanks in no small measure to C.Q. Brown?
That's precisely where we find ourselves. And the fact that this has gone on in the Air Force, and that the Air Force is now the lowest rank a branch of our military in terms of military readiness, it ranks at the bottom. This alone disqualifies Brown as being a viable candidate to bring back our military. I mean, absolutely. You look at what he's done, and you can't point to any real successes in terms of building the morale of the Air Force.
Mm. We're out of time, unfortunately, Scott, and there's so much more to talk about this, and I hope you'll come back. The Senate of the United States is supposed to consider this nomination soon, and I just want people on notice that if senators vote for C.Q. Brown to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not only will he be, well, endorsed in these very policies, but I think that the policies themselves will have been endorsed by the Senate. The National Defense Authorization Act has been under review in the Senate now and previously in the House. We need it to fix some of these policies. We do not need it under the sort of rule of someone who embraces and epitomizes them. Reject C.Q. Brown. Reject General Brown. .org is a place where you can lend your voice to doing so. Thank you, Scott. Come back to us soon if you would. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Thank you, Frank.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have with us for the first time Dr. Mark Richards. He is a Yale-trained medical doctor, a specialist in plastic surgery, which he has been performing for 30 years. He is an international lecturer on that subject, among others, and the author of a very important new book. It is entitled, Nobody Wants You Healthy. The subtitle of which is Achieving Better Health by Avoiding the Corruptions in Modern Medical Science. This is a big topic, Doctor. We don't have a lot of time to get into the thesis, but I'm very keen to hear about it and look forward to a longer visit with you on another occasion if we can. But give us sort of the short form of what you are warning of, based on a lot of experience, including as a consultant to the White House, and what we have best be doing about it.
Well, when I graduated medical school in 1983, the dean at his graduation speech said, "We gave you the best medical education possible, but we have one little admission to make. Half of what we told you was wrong. And your job for the next 40 years is to figure out which half it is." And we all laughed thinking it was a joke, but he was absolutely true. And so a couple decades into my practice, I was lecturing in Paris at a very large aesthetic medicine and surgery conference and was asked to review an anti-aging conference that was happening the day before by the director, which I did. And it really changed my life by accident. I went to that conference fighting tooth and nail, but heard from opinions that were not mainstream and started looking into it and started delving into the research, being the geek I am, spending 10,000 hours, 20,000 hours by now, going into the original research of what is making us so chronically ill. And what I found was it wasn't really a grand conspiracy to make us sick, but it's everybody following their own interests. It's the pharmaceutical companies following their fiduciary responsibility, which is to enrich their shareholders. It's insurance companies following their fiduciary responsibility to enrich their shareholders. Hospital corporations doing the same thing. And the thing that pays the best, according to Goldman Sachs analysis in 2018, is chronic disease. Because $1.4 trillion in global pharma revenues annually, 90% comes from treating but never curing or preventing chronic disease. Wow.
So $1.4 trillion is the revenue.
Right.
And 90% of that is basically prolonging chronic disease. Is that fair to say?
In essence, yes, it is. It is. And so there's no incentive. As Selvin Richter of Goldman Sachs said in 2018, if we ever start preventing or curing chronic disease, the pharmaceutical equities are just going to collapse.
Wow.
Wow.
So they've got a profound interest, shall we say, in perpetuating disease. There are other factors that you've identified at work as well in why there is so much of it, environmental among them. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. You see, this is the another shoe that or other leg of the three-legged table that's hitting. We developed something called plastics in the 1960s and 70s, if you remember the movie The Graduate.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And plastics are really miraculous, right? They're miraculous. But what we didn't realize then, but everybody knows now, is that the chemical that makes plastics act like plastics, whether it's bendable, foldable, you know, brittle, hard, is called phthalates. It's a class of chemicals called phthalates. And phthalates are the most powerful hormone disruptors we've ever created in mass production. We make so many phthalates now that we create 200 times the toxic dose for every man, woman, child on the planet annually. And what do phthalates do? Well, it's hormone disruption.
And that's not to say the cumulative effect of all of the plastics that have been generated in previous years. So,
exactly. That's right.
Unbelievable environmental impact.
It's unbelievable. And so many people, unless they've taken advanced biology courses, don't really understand what a hormone is. But when we evolved past a single cell organism on the planet into multiple cellular organisms, the cells had to communicate. The way they communicated was by creating a substance, a hormone, that transmitted messages back and forth to the other cells so they could behave in unison as a single organism.
Well, I've never had that explained so simply and clearly. That's a terrific model. Thank you.
And the most abundant hormone in both men and women, this will shock you, but the most abundant hormone in men and women their entire life is testosterone. And people think, oh, testosterone is a sex hormone, it's a male hormone, whatever. It's not. Testosterone is probably the oldest hormone, evolutionarily speaking, and it controls inflammation, and it controls metabolism, the most important things for a cell, and it controls immunity. So when you now
and
have...
inflammation brings you disease, as a general...
Inflammation brings you chronic disease. Yeah. So does disruptions in metabolism. It brings you obesity and diabetes. So when you have inflammation, you have tremendous chronic disease. People don't realize this, but when your brain is inflamed, for example, you have depression, you have Alzheimer's, you have cognitive impairment. People don't realize that testosterone is what creates 100% of the estrogen in our cells, whether we're male or female. Estrogen can't go from the bloodstream into your cells. It has to be created in each cell because cells like your bone cells need 3 or 4 times more estrogen in them than your skin cells. So the only way your body can be designed to really make adequate levels is if each cell makes the amount it needs.
Right. And so if hormone disrupting plastics and the phthalates that are operating there are interfering with the normal functioning of those cells, it translates into inflammation and metabolic problems, which creates chronic disease. Have I got that?
You summarized it perfectly, Mr. Gaffney. Well,
so diabetes, when you see that as the kind of cumulative legacy of modern civilization, and the further production of the plastics is a rate that you've described, is there any hope for, you know, curing chronic disease as you see it, sir?
Well, we've done a really good job of messing up animal life, including human life on the planet, with these toxins. Let me give you one example and then say things we can do to make this better. It's a many hundred year problem to clean up all the phthalates in the environment with at least today's technology. I live in the Maryland area. We have Chesapeake Bay that most people have heard of. There's three rivers going into the Chesapeake Bay where over 60% of the bass, the rockfish, are hermaphrodite. They can't reproduce because of all the phthalates in the riverbeds from plastic beads. Shocking, right? Well, the same thing's happening
to humans. Plastic beads being what?
From facial wash and
breaking down.
Breaking down, and it releases phthalates in the water, and it disrupts their sexual differentiation.
And what does it do if people eat the bass that are hermaphrodites?
Well, you get your phthalates levels elevated, and so your immunity, for example, would be impaired. Your inflammation would be increased. Your inability to handle sugars properly and become diabetic, that would be increased because your testosterone is being dropped.
Right, and which is increasing inflammation, rather.
Which is increasing inflammation. Yeah. For example, during the COVID years, a German-Italian study showed that men with low testosterone had a 9 times higher risk of dying or being in the intensive care unit from COVID, because testosterone blocks the inflammatory cytokines and increases the anti-inflammatory cytokines. And inflammation is what kills many of us.
So the answer... We're narrowing down the amount of time we have to get to the answer. Let's talk about that to the extent there is
an answer. So there's the short-term answer and there's the long-term answer. The short-term answer is that since 1939, we have been using testosterone pellets, which are about a little bigger than a Tic Tac, placed into the fat of men and women to cure various diseases. And it was taught in med school until about 1960, at which time the pharmaceutical industry realized they could make synthetic hormones, which are patentable, as opposed to human testosterone, which is not patentable, and all the education stopped. So by using this technology, which is tried, true, tested, and works incredibly well, you can put testosterone pellets in men and women when their testosterone levels are no longer adequate to help their body with metabolic problems like diabetes or inflammatory problems such as joint pain, you know, or brain inflammation or a heart disease, strokes, that sort of thing. And you can make people much, much better. You can reduce heart attacks, according to the literature, by 50, 60%. You can slow or even arrest Alzheimer's development. You can cure menopausal symptoms. You can reduce breast cancer by 40 to 50%.
And basically what you're saying is it's just a matter of balancing properly hormonal, you know, content, I guess, activity in your system. Have I got that right? Is the essence of the answer?
You're absolutely correct. That's the answer. You have to have hormone balance. And I've teach doctors from around the country, actually around the world, in this therapy. And I've even had the former vice president of health for the United Nations who said, yeah, you could reduce Medicare expenses by 50, 60%. And the medical director of pharma who attended one of my courses, who will remain nameless, he no longer works there, so they can't fire him, who said, yeah, you know, everything you said is true. And I thought that science was true. And he said, you know, but my employer will do everything up to and perhaps over the gray line to prevent this from becoming mainstream.
Thank you for smoking is the bottom line.
Yeah.
Doctor, this is such important content, and I am anxious to have a longer chat about it. Dr. Mark Richards, thank you for joining us today. We'll talk with you again very soon, sir. Nobody Wants You Healthy is the book. Check it out. I'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, the House of Representatives felt compelled to affirm America's support for the State of Israel. It effectively repudiated the rising democratic anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism before a senior Israeli official speech today to a congressional joint session. Unfortunately, the Biden administration's policy towards the Jewish state reflects such vile sentiments too, as evidenced by, among other things, the choice of its head of state, not the leader of its government, to address our nation. Team Biden is working with President Yitzhak Herzog's leftist allies who seek to overthrow a man they all detest, who happens to be Israel's democratically elected leader, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Worse yet, Obama-Biden 3.0 persists in empowering those seeking the destruction of our most important ally in the Middle East. Consequently, Iran and its proxies are becoming more dangerously aggressive by the day. Please, repudiate these policies, too. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have with us one of our favorite guests, a regular featured commentator and analyst for this program, but also a font of information through platforms like his jihadwatch.org and his publications at places like PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, as well as, of course, his books, of which there are a legion now, including most recently The Sumter Gambit, about how the left is fomenting a civil war here in the United States. His name is, of course, Robert Spencer. He is a great friend as well as a great valued colleague, and we're delighted to have him back with us. Robert, welcome once again.
Thank you, Frank.
I want to start by asking you about a visit that is taking place this week in Washington, D.C., of the president of Israel, Yitzhak Herzog is his name. He is going to be making an address to a joint session of Congress, which is a little curious because he's sort of the figurehead, I think it's fair to say, a ceremonial post. The president of Israel typically is regarded as, a senior official, but not the man who runs the country. That would be Benjamin Netanyahu. What's up with this particular arrangement, Robert Spencer?
Frank, this is a calculated attempt to undermine the Netanyahu government on the part of the Biden administration. The Biden administration, of course, has been working in numerous ways to destroy the Netanyahu government because it very much favors a leftist government in Israel. Herzog is a member of the Labor Party and thus a key figure on the Israeli left. And so to have Biden refusing to meet with Netanyahu when he meets with actual tyrants all over the world and is anxiously trying to conclude an agreement even now with the Islamic Republic of Iran, that's egregious enough in itself. And now it's compounded by bringing what you note correctly is essentially a figurehead in to speak to Congress. The whole effort is to work toward the fall of the Netanyahu government, to bring about an Israeli regime that is more to the liking of the Biden regime.
Now, am I correct, and I think that's a brilliant analysis of the situation, Robert, that the President of the United States has not yet met with the Prime Minister of Israel?
He's explicitly refused to do so. He will not do so until Netanyahu grants him various policy concessions in regard to his attempts to reform the judiciary and in regard to so-called settlements in Judea and Samaria, also known as the West Bank.
Concessions, in other words, to the Palestinians in the case of the West Bank issue, as well as, of course, concessions to the left. And Herzog has been playing a role, as I understand it, with respect to specifically this whole program of judicial reform, which has been at best a double game, and at worst has been rather subversive of the prime minister's efforts to find a sort of common ground on what is broadly, I understand, with the Israeli population, the electorate, a very, if not universal, certainly widely supported proposition, which is that the elected government of Israel should be running the government, not this sort of self-appointed judicial tyranny. Have I got that right?
Yes, exactly, Frank. The Israeli government, as it is currently constituted, grants broad powers to the judiciary to override various measures that might be favored by the elected government. And that's all that Netanyahu wants to change. It's actually a completely democratic measure that would restore the power to the people rather than to this unaccountable small group that has the power to override the will of the people.
And that small group is very hard left in the Supreme Court specifically, but I think the judiciary and actually even the Attorney General and his team are working for the judicial branch, not for the government. It's a bizarre situation, and yet it does seem to be animating much of the hostility and subversiveness of American policy. I'm told that notwithstanding all of this, Herzog's role in sort of advancing this subdermining of Netanyahu, that the so-called squad is not going to be present for the Herzog speech. This is, I suppose, a symptom of their general enmity towards the state of Israel. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and some of the others have explicitly announced that they're boycotting the speech because they consider Israel to be a racist, apartheid regime. Representative Jayapal got herself in some trouble when she said openly that she thought Israel was a racist state and then had to walk back her remarks in the face of numerous people who were pointing out how ridiculous and fallacious they really were. The left is increasingly anti-Israel, and this is becoming mainstream. And I think that the broad anger over Herzog's speech is an indication of this. They will gladly sabotage the Biden administration's attempts to aid the Israeli left by bringing Herzog here because they hate Israel more than that. They don't care if it's left or right. They want the whole thing destroyed.
I have to say, Robert is a longtime supporter of the state of Israel and very much convicted that it is a key ally, if not our most important ally, certainly most important ally in the Middle East, confronting our mutual enemy, Iran, and otherwise trying to maintain a sort of stability in the region that is very much in our interest. This kind of behavior by the Biden administration and its leftist friends and outliers is shocking. And yet it is so persistent. It is not an accident. It is very deliberate. And I think it is to be condemned. Perhaps that would be a nice thing for Herzog to do, but I'm not holding my breath on it. Robert, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. We're back, and Robert Spencer is with us virtually. We're always pleased to be able to say that, especially at a moment when there is considerable ferment in the part of the battle space that he monitors with great care and authority, namely what I call the phenomenon of Sharia supremacist efforts to impose Islam, as they construe it, on the rest of us through violent jihad. And Robert, you've written books and countless articles about jihad. Of course, it is something that you bring awareness to all of us about through your work at jihadwatch.org. One of the things that I particularly prize about your products are that you call attention to events that are assiduously described as something other than jihad. For example, an attack in Fargo, North Dakota. Talk a little bit about it and what we should understand is afoot there rather than what we are being told is, well, basically nothing to see here, folks.
Frank, on Friday afternoon, there was a traffic accident in Fargo, North Dakota, and several police officers responded to the call. It was an extraordinarily routine situation until a man who was standing in a parking lot about 20 feet away from the accident, standing behind his car, opened up his trunk, took out a gun, and started shooting at the police. He killed one of them and wounded two others, and his name was Mohammed Barakat. Now, nothing else has been released since then about who Mohammed Barakat was or what he was up to, and the police chief in Fargo has expressed complete bafflement as to why he did this and what he could have been wanting to accomplish. Now,
just for the record, he was not involved in the accident. He did not get provoked for that reason. This is something else.
He was just standing by. It's not known how it is that he happened to be there at the scene of an accident. Maybe the accident was caused by somebody who was connected to him. We don't know. Nothing has been released. Maybe the police don't know. But it should be noted that ISIS, the Islamic State, has repeatedly called upon Muslims in the United States and Europe to attack police officers in any way that they can and to take opportunities to do so whenever they present themselves. Now, this is a possibility that has not been broached by the news media or by the police or by anybody connected with the shooting in Fargo. And yet it seems to be a rather obvious possibility. And the fact that it's being so steadfastly ignored. Now, here, I'm not saying that this is necessarily what happened, but the fact that it is being so completely ignored is unwise, because it may be that that's exactly what's going on, and that the willful ignorance that our authorities are involved in is going to make sure that there are more such attacks.
Robert, your warnings on this score are something that has unfortunately been a repeated point, because whether the information involving something like this is being suppressed, or as often as not, we're being told it has nothing to do with jihad or, you know, terrorism for that matter. It's infuriating to me, and I can only imagine how unbelievably frustrating it is to you, as the obvious explanation seems always to be discounted. Sometimes it may not be right, and that is fair to rule out if it's not, but so much of this pattern of behavior, if I could use that expression, does seem to suggest a willful blindness, as I think you put it. This is not happening in isolation, of course, and it's not just the Islamic State that is promoting jihad. We've been talking with, among others, Sam Faddis on this program about the knock-on effects of Joe Biden's surrender of Afghanistan to the Taliban and the windfall of $83 billion or so worth of arms and so on, and what that's doing to restore the safe haven for terrorism and the, you know, platform for plotting further attacks. Al-Qaeda is there, ISIS is there, and many others, of course, the Taliban as well. Another place where this is in evidence at the moment, this, jihadist insurgency, I would call it, is the nation of France. What can you tell us about what is happening there? And it seems as though there's similar kind of pattern is taking place here, where it's got nothing to do with that problem, folks. Don't worry about it. It's just it was another traffic incident, actually. Tell us the ground truth as you see it, Robert, with respect to France and the problem
we're dealing with. The riots that were nationwide in France recently were carried out overwhelmingly by Muslim migrants who live in the areas surrounding France's major cities and really all over the country. They were captured on video numerous times shouting Allahu Akbar. They attacked churches. Some of them were caught on video explicitly saying that Allah had given them permission in the Quran to attack French people because of alleged French wrongs against Arab Muslims. Now, this was completely ignored by the French government and media. And as a matter of fact, I believe it was the French foreign minister who said, oh, there were a lot of Kevins and Mateos among the rioters, that is, native French people who were involved in the recent unrest. Now, this is completely misleading. And he was even more misleading in saying that most of the rioters were French citizens, which doesn't actually mean anymore that they were not Muslim Arabs who want Sharia. And so here again, we have this denial and willful ignorance on a massive scale in order to protect the government from justifiable criticism for its disastrous migration policies.
Migration policies and arguably handling of this rising internal threat that has arisen as a result of it as well. Robert, we're out of time. Alas, long before we're out of things to talk with you about, I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you in the meantime for all you do at jihadwatch.org and with us, of course, at the Center for Security Policy. Speaking of Afghanistan, I recommend strongly Robert's great book for the Center for Security Policy Press, Who Lost Afghanistan. Talk to you soon, my friend. I hope the rest of you will come back to us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.